Welcome to the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI. And today we are thrilled to sit down with Andre Quadrado. But before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Andre is the founder and principal of Rhenium Capital, a boutique national loan sale advisory firm and CEO of Exchange.Loans. Based on extensive experience selling non-performing loans for community banks, private lenders, regional and large banks, as well as special servicers, Andre developed the Exchange.Loans platform specifically to maximize the recoverable value of non-performing loans in a secure open market transaction. Prior to founding both firms, Andre founded and ran the V&A department of Auction.com, Commercial, now 10X, and was an originations analyst for ING Investment Management, now Voya. Andre, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we covered a little bit about your background, but I'd like to dive in and go into a little more detail. How did you first get involved in commercial real estate, particularly in the field of distressed assets?
I got into real estate. That story starts in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I was on a radio watch, a 12-hour radio watch with the Navy SEAL, very late at Bagram Air Force Base. And I had read all three Lord of the Rings books. I just finished Return of the King and had absolutely nothing to do. The radio was totally silent. And the SEAL sitting next to me was reading all these books on real estate. And I said, hey, I'm bored out of my mind. Can I see some of those books? So he started passing them over and he was explaining to me how he and his buddies were getting together and going to pool their hazard pay to start investing in real estate. So reading through it, it started making a lot of sense to me as an investment vehicle and a career path. So I actually applied for Georgia State University from Afghanistan, got accepted. And after my second tour, I got out and went directly to school, majored in real estate at GSU, graduated, and got hired by ING as an analyst on the lending side. Now I got into distress because I got hired in 07 and then 08 happened. Right. So everybody that was in the biz got into distress at the time. We started out originations doing pretty large balance sheet deals, commercial real estate. They primarily focused industrial, but when the proverbial crap hit the fan, we did nothing for a few months, just hoping that we wouldn't get laid off. And I guess being the lowest paid guy in the office, because I was the last hire, I got lucky. And we shifted from, first originations to doing nothing to portfolio management. We didn't really have too many defaults on the balance sheet side, other than some stuff in Detroit, which actually my business partner, Mike Jimenez, he actually worked on some loan sales from off the balance sheet at ING. He left before I did, but, we were getting into the CMBS purchases that the bond guys did upstairs. They purchased, small parts of different tranches of securitizations, and nobody knew what the hell was on the books. So we ended up becoming forensic underwriting analysts, using what we learned on the origination side to basically go back through and re-underwrite everything and see what was going on. And we lifted up some rocks and uncovered some hairy, hairy spiders doing. We saw fraud. We saw, non-viable business plans. We saw everything. And we saw the most aggressive underwriting and appraisals that got these deals through. And these were deals that got investment grade ratings because, ING was not buying, junk bonds and they were not investment grade. It was,
how do you, and it's interesting because I would assume that being a forensic underwriter requires a deeper level of understanding of underwriting in general, where do you develop those skills to get into the kind of that field?
You know, that's an interesting question. There's not a school for it. And we, we have this conversation quite a bit with our current clients and past clients now, because as a lender, you know, when you're originating a deal, you're getting a third party assessment of what the collateral's worth. So you're getting an MAI appraisal, and that's, you know, you obviously do your internal underwriting, but then you get your third party stamp and verification, whether it's a bank, LifeCo, CMBS, it's very standard. Mm-hmm. The issue that you run into, I guess, as a lender when a deal goes bad is appraisers can't underwrite a deal as distressed. They can't. If it goes against USPAP regulations, they can't go in and opine on, hey, this is why the deal went bad and this is what's wrong. You know, they can't go in and say, you know, the borrower's getting sued by 20 people for fraud and he's commingling funds. That's not the purpose of an appraisal or even a BOV or even a commute. So, you know, somebody, I guess, loan sale advisory type or special assets internally is the person that has to untangle the hairball. And it's definitely different. It's a bit of an art and a bit of a science, but I guess you could say the same thing about appraisals. But half my job is underwriting. And, interestingly, getting into being a loan sale advisor, I've never been a broker. I got my broker's license just to help serve my clients, because if they have REO that they want to sell with loans, I have to be a licensed broker. But I was always a lender, and I underwrite as a lender. And as a matter of fact, that's why I got hired by LNR for the auction.com REDC joint venture. Mm-hmm. They hired me because they had a lot of brokers on staff that were working to sell, the LNR loans, but they didn't really have people that knew how to actually underwrite them and recommend pricing and guide the market. So I actually, going from ING, I actually left ING to go there in 2011 after the market started, the credit market started defrosting, and we were starting to originate again, albeit with much more conservative underwriting standards. Right. We were very conservative anyway, because we were a life co-lender, but, jumping headlong into, the defaulted CMBS loan sales, in that auction.com environment, I had a bit of a leg up just from the forensic underwriting that I learned at ING, and we didn't learn it. We made it up as we went along. And I brought that, over to auction as well. And I ended up leveraging that knowledge, moving from just doing loan sales to actually, requesting and, a department to start underwriting the deals coming in. And,
right.
Fast forward, 3 years later, I had a team of six people, and we underwrote pretty much every deal coming in nationwide and recommended reserve pricing. We looked at over 10,000 deals doing that.
Wow.
And it was almost the same, philosophy. Like I created even just the underwriting forms at auction. It was basically from memory, the same type of thing that we were doing at ING. You're comping it, you're figuring out what's going on, but then you're trying to find the issue, the hairball, right? The spider under the rock. And, maybe sometimes it wasn't there, but, quite often it was at the time. And I know we're going to chat about auctions, but auctions still, I don't want to say they have a stigma for doing distressed. I think auctions are the best way to sell distressed assets.
Yeah.
Hands down, especially REO, especially real estate owned. You have to figure out what's going wrong, because you have to disclose it.
Right.
You have to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think to that point, with the wider availability of auction tools now, I think that it's really put the tools in the hands of the brokers to be able to utilize auction in more instances than, just institutions that were using auctions to, get mm-hmm. things off their books, money, quick, move on, right? And
yes.
I think now with the, wider availability of tools, we're starting mm-hmm. to see that perception of, auction is just the dog with fleas. It's now, the purebred border collie, because people are conducting an auction anyway, but yeah. not on a platform. Usually it's, broker's process that it's mm-hmm. extremely competitive.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, you can look around and, you know, I can name drop some very squared away folks out there in the biz that have made careers and basically made a new form of brokerage, which is the online auction specialized broker.
Right.
And they're selling a lot of deals, and there's absolutely a need and a necessity for people that are familiar with the tools, can get their clients and customers familiar, I mean, comfortable with them utilizing the tools and trusting the process to actually get the deal done.
Right.
And there's, a plethora of reasons why that's, for many cases, that is the absolute best option for the sale.
Right. Well, I'm curious, what led you to starting your own firm?
Well, it's interestingly, when I was over at auction, again, we looked at a ton of deals and I chatted with a lot of different people, whether it was actually the individual private sellers and their brokers that were selling their assets, all the way to just the institutional asset managers that were, looking at deals to sell. We didn't know they were going to rebrand the 10X, but we knew they were trying to move away from distressed. It started as a joke between myself and my business partner, Mike. It was, if they really want to move away from distress, we should totally start our own shop that goes after that business, because there's really nowhere else for it to go. And it started out as just a joke over some Starbucks at a lunch. And, fast forward to 2015, we opted to step out and form Rhenium Capital, which we stepped out on our own to start going after this business. And even the first year we were in business, we ended up signing up a distressed NPL and REO combo, and we actually sold it on 10X.
Wow. So,
yeah, this was way back in 2015. And if you're going after that business, it's very different from traditional brokerage. Your client is extremely different. Their motivations are extremely different than an individual private seller. And if it's a non-performing loan, it's very, very different from, the motivations are very different. If you're looking at banks specifically, they look at their books on an accrual basis. So they don't necessarily care if they're making money on the sale, and they'll have a reserve or something to hit because that's what they can bear. And if they can't hit that, they may take 2, 3, 4 quarters to write the asset down to take that, or they may opt to foreclose or do something different. Mm-hmm. But what was the question again? I'm kind of going off on a tangent.
Well, I'm curious, it must have, we were talking about, what led you to start your own firm, but yeah. I'm curious, obviously to do that, you must have had a lot of confidence in, what you were seeing, or at least the space in the market that you thought, hey, there is an opportunity here. What lessons did you learn early on, once you did start, right, and you were off on your own, or what mentors worked with you to kind of help you, get into the groove and find success?
We had no mentors because, to be honest with you, nobody bootstraps a boutique loan sale advisory firm ever. Everybody, if somebody starts one of these, typically speaking, they're funded by investor capital. We're bootstrapped. We've taken no money. We've been able to survive based on the fees that we've generated. So it's been hard and very painful, but it takes time. One thing I definitely learned, whether you're, a Marcus broker / Mission Capital that's just getting into loan sales, or somebody from CBRE or NGKF, and I'm sure they can attest to it as well, is it takes a long time to build trust and cultivate the relationship. And even if you have the relationship, the sellers, whether it's special servicers, banks, even private lenders, they're operating on their own time schedule. And it is very different from, you wanting to sell.
Right.
Half of my job is underwriting. I wish if I sold every single deal that I've underwritten, man, I'd say probably 60% underwriting, 40% selling. Because the term is not broker. The term is loan sale advisor. You really are an advisor. Because they're weighing and assessing their options. If a deal goes bad, they have 3 options, right? They can work out a deal with the borrower, whether it's a discounted payoff or a short sale with a discounted payoff, or maybe even some kind of forbearance or payments restructure. they can foreclose and go after the collateral and foreclose, or they can sell the loan. So they need the best information to make that decision. And you're only one of three options, right?
Right.
We go in, we do very in-depth asset summary reports. We lay bare and expose what's going on with the deal and why. So we have to basically do two underwritings when we look at a deal. You know, we even though they'll have a third party appraisal or a broker's opinion of value, we have to re-underwrite the collateral, and we underwrite it as distressed, right? And then we have to underwrite the paper, because that's always different. That varies. You have to know, you know, all the statutes per state. You even have to know sometimes counties, which counties take longer to foreclose and why. And then you have to basically make a case. So it's, you know, anybody out there that's ever been a lender knows that when a loan goes to committee, there's a massive loan package that's pitched internally. Nobody ever sees. When it goes to committee, there's always a gigantic Word file and a gigantic Excel file with the actual loan underwriting on it. And we're basically reproducing that. And it's, again, it's one of three options. So they're going to go take our report, take the appraisal, and then take their own internal report on, you know, what a potential workout would look like, sit around in a committee, a pre-committee, take a look, discuss it, and then have a committee, discuss it again. And then, you know, maybe I get, it's a 33% chance I get the call that they say, hey, we're ready to move forward with the loan sale.
Interesting. So there's a lot of work that goes in on the front end.
Tons. Yes.
At what point or how do you decide whether an asset is right for auction or not?
Well, I guess it depends. And we'd have to go deep into define how you're defining auction. We like to sell all of our assets online if the seller is okay with that. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the method to do so, if you're talking incremental bid auction versus blind call for offers, we can get into the weeds on that, but either way, it's still, you know, utilizing an online tool and marketing system to sell a deal. Now, sometimes the sellers may object, where this usually happens with banks when they say, we don't want the borrower to know the loans for sale. And so and sometimes it's not just loans for sale. Banks will do what they call a relationship disposition, meaning if they have other loans, like anything they have to this guy, they just want him off the books. So you're actually, you're selling everything that he has to this bank.
Firing your
on
client.
The open market. Yeah, exactly. 100%, which happens a lot. It happens probably more than you would think. But typically speaking, those, they may say, hey, look, you know, is there, you know, we would prefer not to have a public, you know, public auction, you know, marketed publicly. Is there, you know, a confidential way you can market, which we don't like to do that, because we think if you don't bring a market to a deal, your odds are you're leaving money on the table and you're probably not going to get best execution.
Right.
But, you know, every single deal that we get, we want to use the online marketing tools to sell it, unless the seller objects explicitly.
Nice. Well, I'm curious your opinion. Why choose an auction over other disposition methods?
Well, you know, when you look at loan sales, it's, I guess, probably way more than traditional real estate sales, is you have a very diverse buyer profile, right? You have owner operators, owner managers, funds. You have, you know, sometimes other banks will buy subperforming debt just to restructure it. These different groups have a vast array of pricing, because they're going to price over extremely different metrics. And if you're going to, you know, if as a seller, you want to get best pricing and execution, you want to show it to all of them. And there's no better way to do it than, you know, the online auction process. You know, here's a great example for you. We had a deal, non-performing loan on a single family rental pool, a single first lien commercial loan docs on a single family rental pool in Polk County, Florida. Very hot market, equidistant between Tampa and Orlando. And, you know, we took it online through the process for sale. We had 26 bidders, unique bidders on it. And the winner was from Paris, France, and he blew everybody else out the water. He actually bid from Paris because he said he winters in Tampa, and he owns 350 single family rental units in the area. And he ended up owning a property next door to one of the properties in the pool in the portfolio. So, you know, from a lender's perspective, a lot of them, you know, you'll get the, hey, we sell these deals. Or first off, they'll say, none of our deals ever go bad. Yeah, we don't worry about that. And then they say, well, we do it ourselves. We do it in-house. Well, okay, that's fine, right? You can call your buyer, your current clients, and they're going to give you an offer. Maybe they executed on it. Maybe they don't. But the buyer's profile is so unique and so vast and so varied in loan sales. It's not uncommon to have a top bidder bid double what the number two bidder bid, you know? So how do you gut check, you know, your current client, if you're getting the best pricing for it? And, you know, the smart banker is going to say, well, we always sell at par. Well, that Florida deal sold for 125% to par. So, right. So, you know, they never would have found him unless they actually, let us use the process. And that's exactly what it did.
And the process really does open up the playing field and allow people in France to compete, right? Where otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, the status quo prior to COVID, you know, a lot of auctions were done in person, right?
Yes.
And, you know, got to go to the county courthouse steps, right? Mm-hmm. You know, technology has shifted pretty rapidly post COVID in a way that, you know, everything is being done online now. It only makes sense that auctions, you know, would find a home in the online space, right?
Yep.
Now you don't actually have to go to the county courthouse steps. You know, you can go to Crexie, you can go to, you know, an online platform, and you can register and with property from anywhere.
Yes.
How have your methods or have they changed in terms of identifying a property for fit for auction mm-hmm. with the way that tech has evolved?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say they've changed. We've always, you know, I always joke about that. I do a lot of bank special assets panels, you know, and I actually speak a lot on auctions and online marketing for platforms. Most bankers that are in charge of special asset disposition, they're boomers. They're older folks. They were around during the RTC days where, you know, they were a brand new fresh banker working the special assets division, and they, you know, when deals had to sell off, there was a warehouse full of documents, and they would be overseeing it, and they'd let people in, and they'd ruffle through the papers and say, hey, you know, I'll give you 30 cents on the dollar for this. This is literally how it worked
right
back in the day. And,
panning for gold, looking through the crap and see if you can find something really that shines at you and say, I can do something with that.
Yeah. But the thing is, there was, you know, let's be frank. There's no way the banks knew what was in those docs. No way. And a lot of times, like, the buyers got really good deals. You know, hey, I give you 30 cents on the dollar, but, you know, they end up making a 250% return on that, because that's the dinosaur life of paper, right? I mean, it is what it is. You know, now, you know, like I say on the panels, like, I'm from the auction.com generation. You know, I got out of ING Investment Management and into auction.com, which was the first real breakout, large scale, successful marketing and disposition for distressed assets via the auction process. So that's all I know. So
right.
When I got out and formed Rhenium, you know, the purpose was to go out as a loan sale advisor, win the business. And I'm competing against very large brokerages. You know, it's just initially it was just two guys on our laptops. But the game changer, the great equalizer, was the fact that I was very skilled and adept in selling assets online through the auction process. And
right.
I was able to compete and win business based on that. So, you know, on one side, I had 10,000 underwritten deals under my belt to go through and tell them what was wrong with it. On the other side, you know, I had online, you know, knowledge and trust in the online auction space to actually get deals done. That was the business plan from day one.
You know, you can't really understate how powerful an advancement in technology can be in terms of, you know, really any space. But, you know, to approach these, you know, larger sophisticated firms with, you know, that you're competing against, that they have inferior tools. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're approaching it with, you know, a much more sophisticated way of, you know, doing a disposition. You know, it's like going hunting, you know, it's one mm-hmm. guy has a bow and arrow, the other has, you know, a SOCOM rifle, you know, it's the technology is going to win, even if it's mm-hmm. a smaller, you know, smaller team, you know, the technology really gives you that advantage. Now, have you seen a shift or a change in buyers or sellers when it comes to, you know, online transactions?
You know, it's funny you say that. One of the coolest things coming out of, I guess, the last downturn was the revolution in, not just the revolution in technology, but it was the culture shift, right? And of course you can say this, you know, the sellers, they were ready to accept, you know, somebody using, you know, an online, you know, auction disposition process to sell their assets. It's not, you know, they won't look at you like you're crazy. But I think the real culture shift is the culture shift that the buyers have done since this concept came out. And, you know, it's not stated very often, but I think the biggest culture shift was the acceptance of buyers to bid with bid deposits and non-negotiable contracts. That was huge. That was absolutely friggin' huge coming out of the last downturn.
Right.
You know, that, cause that's, I mean, you guys, I think I saw your commercial, which is awesome. Real estate's about people. And I agree 100%. But if you're going to get tech adaptation and make it scalable, the fact that that happened, that's really what made it scalable. Now, I guess we're all building, you know, business models based off that because it's huge. It's very huge.
Why did they get more comfortable? Is it because the technology allowed them to virtually do their due diligence? Or because a lot of transactions are happening sight unseen, but mm-hmm. I know on our platform, we require quite a bit of due diligence. So because the tools are there, or, I mean, I have to assume before the internet, there were ways of obtaining information, right?
Yeah.
So what made that shift happen in your opinion?
Well, actually the technology did play quite a role. And, you know, just going back to the RTC days, like I mentioned, the due diligence was rifling through papers. And then eventually someone's just going to take a flyer on it. Now you can have all of the information in one place organized. You know, that's another one, the online due diligence vault. Now banks, when they sell the deals individually, they'll shoot a link directly to their virtual data room, their war room, and people can take a look. But having all of the docs there, and then quite often requiring no due diligence in the auction process and still having people accept it with the non-negotiable docs, absolutely huge. But, you know, the fact that it's all the information was right there at their fingertips anyway. And, enabling the buyer to have direct contact with the broker who has direct contact with the seller, and then everything is transparent for them. That's what allowed them to do that. Now, the other thing that kind of forced it into the culture was the fact that the rolling that out online in, you know, 2010, 2011, these are deals that the people that ended up bidding on them would never have had access to bid on before. Ever. Typically speaking, if you're going to talk about like the loan sale space, prior to this, most of the time they were sold in bulk, large portfolios.
Right. Big packages.
One or two of my competitors out there who I'm not going to name, who still do that, and, you know, more power to them. I think that's a great way to dispose of deals for a large bank that doesn't want to deal with the individual transactions. But to be perfectly frank,
leaving a lot of money on the table doing
tons.
Because it's not just that package. It's how many people will compete on every single thing inside the package too. And, you know, some are going to outperform others, but if you're lumping them all together and just, you know, saying we'll take the average, right. Mm-hmm. Then you really are missing out on those, you know, outlier spikes that are really going to mitigate some of the losses there.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. And that's another thing that, really the tech has enabled is the ability to, we affectionately here call it wholetailing. You know, you're wholesaling your loan portfolio, but you're retailing them out to individuals. So sure, you know, the Goldman-backed Wall Street fund that needs a 35% return can bid 55 cents on the dollar on the $100 million pool. And that's really easy for the bank to sell it. But let's say you're not Wells Fargo. Let's say you're a community bank, right? And you have three non-performing loans in three different states, right? They're kind of close to your community, right? Mm-hmm. Sure, they'll also bid the same, hey, we still need our 35% return. But the winner, the guy that's going to win that is going to be the guy that says, well, that warehouse that was, you know, an old HVAC contractor, I want to put my business there. So I'm willing to pay 80 cents on the dollar, not 55 cents on the dollar, because I'm fine hiring my lawyer to foreclose and taking that asset. And, this industry has been democratized considerably, you know, based on technological advances and platforms. And I love seeing all these platforms out there. You know, I love throwing my hat in the ring with everybody. And I love seeing them, you know, like, you know, you see it like, hey, I have my platform exchange.loans. I still list all my assets on Crexy as well, because that just widens the pool. It widens the view. And,
right.
And, you know, it gets the buyers get to see it. The sellers get more exposure. You know, everybody wins.
And it is true. Everybody does win when you've got total market awareness and you're really exposing it. You know, you're not going to miss the obvious buyer that just isn't looking the place you put it, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So let's pivot a little bit into current events and economic trends. When you last joined us on Pro Perspective, pandemic was just about 3 months old. It's been about 2 years since, almost to the day. What has...
Feels like 20.
I know, right? trying to think back about it. A lot has, but what's changed in the world of real estate from your purview?
Well, I had a really interesting conversation with Robert on that Pro Perspective. We had laughed. We had an REO deal that we had just sold on Crexy's auction platform after that. But a few months prior, we had five deals either in marketing or some form of closing. All five of them blew up because this all happened in March. So that was the one that we ended up closing on Crexy's auction platform was one of the ones that had blown up that we, you know, got the bank to agree for letting us take it on auction, and we had ended up getting it done. But later in the year, when things started calming down and settling down a little bit, that guy got a great buy also, by the way. So, you know, back then nobody knew what the hell was going on. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I probably spoke about the eviction and foreclosure moratoriums a bit. That was very, very interesting from our perspective, because basically everything was in default at that time. Everything right. on everybody's balance sheet was in some form of default. This time around, the banks, special servicers, everybody, of course, everybody was caught off guard, but it wasn't like 08 where, you know, it was the bank's fault and also the borrower's fault. Well, I mean, you're going to give the borrower money, they're going to take it. But everybody was very understanding this time around. Special servicers, banks, everybody basically, hey, you know, if you can answer these three questions and you have a pulse, we'll give you a forbearance or an interest only period or some one form or the other. So, you know, we went from 98% of everybody's balance sheet in default into forbearance. So, okay, we weren't default. You know, we're all in this together. Let's try to wait out the pandemic. So fast forward 2 years. Again, 60% of my job is underwriting. I've underwritten quite a few deals. And on the commercial real estate sector, I'm seeing problems. I'm seeing problems that, in my opinion, are going to help lead us into the oncoming recession and pricing correction.
Do you think the other shoe hasn't dropped yet from the pandemic?
Elaborate on that. I would love to hear your opinion.
So I think after the pandemic, a lot of people expected, you know, that a lot of loans would go into default. Mm-hmm. It would be foreclosed on. And then mm-hmm. that timeline has just kind of been dragged out. Well, you know, it's coming 6 months. We're probably going to start seeing that happen in 6 months, you know, probably another 6 months. We're probably going to start seeing that happen with, you know, mm-hmm. the economic climate now. Does some of the dominoes that were tipped over at the start of COVID, right? Yeah. Are we still waiting to see the end of that chain today.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Because here's the thing. And I think I explained this pretty much on every single panel I get on regarding state of the market, state of the economy. And this is, I guess, the best analogy I can use. You know, every time there's a, there's four stages to the market. There's growth, expansion, hypersupply, recession, and recovery, right? When COVID was hitting, I would probably say we were nearing the tail end of hypersupply. The economy was cooling off a little bit before we had the artificial pause on everything. So we went from hypersupply to technically nothing because everything was on pause. So we're definitely back in hypersupply. And I would probably say we're tipping at this point, we're tipping into recession. So the question is, okay, what was the cause of hypersupply? In 08, you know, it was the mortgage-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities, lending very aggressively, pushing overall values, which ended up blowing up. And, you know, I ended up doing my small part in sifting through the shifting sands, right? So now, you know, you have your culprit then. It was the securitized lenders, and that's changed. So this time around, what's fueling hypersupply? What's pushing hypersupply? My argument is this time around, the aggressive lender was the federal government, and it was the COVID stimulus specifically. It was the basically free money that rained from the sky. So, I have the underwriting to back this up. I've looked at a lot of deals. So you have, you know, the PPP1, PPP2, which were grants, right? You have the EIDL loans, which up to $2 million, it could be up to twice your top end revenue from 2019, 30-year full pay. So 30-year amortization, 30-year term with a 3.75% rate. That's the absolute cheapest money you could possibly get for a business ever. So, you know, a lot of that money is out in the economy, and I've seen it on a lot of deals' balance sheets, where I am getting deals in coming in from a bank or servicer that sit. Then they say, "Well, this is a performing loan. We want par. We want to sell the loan at par or close to par." So I look at the borrower's business performance and say, you know, either they don't cover their actual revenues, not their PPP forgiveness, or they're in the negative. So I go back to the bank and say, well, this isn't a performing loan because the borrower's not performing, you know? So I've been splitting out net operating income from net income because most of these borrowers aren't doing that. So it's like, okay, well, your NOI is negative 250K, but after all the grants they got and the PPP forgiveness, it's plus 300K. No one's underwriting that number. So the question is, what's the underlying collateral worth? It's definitely not worth what you appraised it for in 2019.
Right.
So, but it's worth something, right? So, you know, I try to take my best guess and stab, but, you know, I say, well, look, you know, nobody really knows, like you said, what's going to happen when the shoe drops. How many businesses went out of business over the past few years? I think everybody was saved by some form of federal stimulus or another. That is going to start defaulting because some of these deals are maturing and there's no way really to get around it unless you're going to extend, which that's tough. I can't imagine a bank extending on a borrower that's, you know, not only doesn't cover, but they're negative X dollars, you know, way underneath a being able to recover. And are they going to be able to turn it around? I don't know. I mean, it looks to me like we're in an inflationary period that's rivals the 1970s and interest rates are going up. So yeah, they're going to be refinancing with a higher rate. Okay. They probably have a floater. So are they going to still be from banks? Banks do most of their loans are adjustable rate for business. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I just know there's a lot of defaults and there's a lot of deals that need to be repriced. You know, then you could talk about, you know, other greater market cycles. You know, everybody was talking about the retail apocalypse before, you know, even before 2020. And I know you probably didn't hear anything about that in ICSC because everybody's happy because either their holding companies got an EIDL loan or their tenants did, right? So, you know, so that was on pause because of the stimulus money. We don't really know the state of the retail market. We just know there's a lot of shortages, a lot of inflation. So consumers' purchasing power is shrinking. That means they're going to buy less. I think Target and Walmart just put out a report on that. So now you have other things that are out there kind of floating around, like the office apocalypse that's coming. And, right. And, you know, Zoom is to office what Amazon is to retail. You know, we're chatting on Zoom right now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm working from home. If you can't tell by well, I blurred it out.
But just tell me industrial, you know, still safe. Okay. I'm knocking on every piece of wood.
Well, Amazon is pulling back on square footage. Like, I think they're looking to pull out of a few billion square feet in the Northeast.
Wow.
Yeah. They just announced that last week because they went on a crazy leasing spree during COVID because their revenues were so high, but even they know that's not sustainable. So now that's going to get subleased. That's going to affect, I hear from, one thing I guess, what comes with this job specifically, loan sale advisory, is you can't have normalcy bias or optimism bias. You know, and I'm not a negative Nancy. I don't scream that the sky's falling, and I don't try to scare my clients to say, oh, you need to sell now because the world's going to end by the end of the year. I just try to give an honest assessment. But there will be no soft landing. Things need to be repriced. And if anybody with a memory, including, my older banker clients, knows what happened to interest rates to stop inflation in the 80s, right? So things need to be repriced.
So speaking of interest rates, how are the current interest rates impacting dispositions and acquisitions? How is inflation impacting business operational performance, et cetera?
I guess looking at the lender's perspective first, we can go there because it really is, what causes a recession is the credit markets. Are they frozen or are they liquid, right? That's really the key. Are banks and lenders lending? Look, we just had a shock, right? We had a 50 basis point raise by the Fed, and I think they basically signaled another one. I think, is it next week? It's coming up pretty quick.
So, yeah.
So, again, I was never a broker. I was a lender. So what happens in a rising interest rate environment is duration on deals get longer with lower interest rates. So banks and lenders are going to start quoting higher spreads when they know the interest rates are going up. If the Fed signaled that they're going to start quoting higher spreads, so now you're going to get higher interest rates. And the credit market's going to start slowing down a little bit because, if you're buying a deal and you were, last year you could have got a 4.5% rate for 10 years. Now you're looking at a 6, you're not going to pay the same for it. Your cap rate's going to widen. It's just the way it is. So this is why I'm pretty confident to say we're out of hypersupply at this point and we're into recession. I guess we're in the early stages of recession. I would say probably we could say we're in 07. We're not in 08 yet. For a comparison, but what turned 08 into 08 was basically the black swan event, right? Lehman, right? But that was a whole bunch of, grains of sand, were dumped into a pile until the pile, fell over. So I think the sand's piling up at this point.
So question for you, with so many new assets potentially coming to auction, what opportunities do you see for those with capital to deploy?
Well, there's a lot of deals coming. I think one of the more interesting ones, and going back to, I mentioned that was at a conference that was an ICSC this week. I was in the single family rental conference, the IMN conference in Miami Beach. Institutional single family rental is relatively new. I think it really started scaling in 2016 with a couple lenders, with B2R and with Colony American Finance at the time, doing these portfolio single family rental loans and securitizing them. So they were kind of, the catalyst for the industry. Now it's really blowing and going. It's even got some mainstream coverage where you hear that investors are buying all the houses and pushing up prices and yada, yada, yada. I think that's a little overblown, but with a new industry, this industry hasn't been tested through a recession yet, but it's about to be. So there's the securitized lenders, the original, the OGs in the game they did probably the more quality assets, and they're probably pretty safe for the most part, where some of that stuff's going to pop up. But there's a lot of other lenders private lenders, they call non-QM, non-qualifying mortgage space, doing single family rental type stuff. And I think they're going to have a lot of defaults, because if you went to this conference, if I had a helmet with a GoPro on at this conference, and you saw some of these lenders' booths with the loan terms that they're offering, you're going to be like, it's deja vu all over again. You're going to be quoting Yogi Berra and thinking back to, 04 through 07 for the crazy loan terms that they're doing. But this is specifically for the single family rental and I guess the investor fix and flip space. So that stuff's coming. I think, which is why I didn't go to ICSC. I went there.
Hey, you go where the opportunity is, right?
Yeah. But that stuff's coming. I think, for an investor looking for yield, the stuff is a little bit higher management intensive, but if you can get some scale on this stuff, if you buy a loan from us that's secured by 20 properties in, I don't know, Atlanta and Nashville, you're going to be pretty safe, and you can still get a pretty good buy for some yield on it. You would just have to make sure your management is squared away. But I think that's going to be a really good opportunity coming up for commercial investors as well. Basically the SFR guys turn residential into a commercial asset. And now there's a lot of management companies that manage it like multifamily. So they're, right. So it's very interesting to see.
An ecosystem is building around that.
Oh, it's built. Yeah. Like there's some really cool, tech platforms for vendor acquisition, management, and it's really cool. Like, so, you know, that's the cool thing when something goes institutional is people will build a lot of infrastructure beneath it to support it. So it's going to make it out of the recession. It won't get totally crammed down and tanked, but it's going to have to be repriced, and the bad loans are going to have to get liquidated. That being said, there's something else popped up relatively recently that I think it can make sense, but there are lenders that do portfolio loans on short-term rentals. So Airbnb portfolio loans.
Interesting.
Very aggressive. And obviously it's very cyclical. One of the bellwethers we've noticed, just generally speaking, for an economic downturn is one of the first sectors that in the commercial real estate space that gets nailed is hotels. Business travel hasn't totally recovered even. So I guess CBD hotels are still kind of hurting. Like you're seeing some loan sales for the larger stuff, like the smaller, the Red Roof Inn along I-95 is fine now. But it's still cyclical. So if you have less travel, less discretionary travel, whether it's, along I-95 or whether it's in the Gotham Hotel in New York City, revenues are down. Their payroll's up too. I mean, we can go into that. The labor shortages, if you want.
Hold another can of worms. If we had another hour, we could.
But let's be honest. I mean, Airbnb loans are basically Airbnb deal, individual deals. It's a hotel, but you're basically a scattered site hotel if you're financing a portion of that. So that stuff, there's probably going to be some opportunities for loan acquisitions there. We've chatted with lenders that do it about potentially selling. Nobody knows where that stuff would price out on the open market, us included. I don't know how the open market would price it, but could be a good opportunity.
It sounds exciting,
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something new. Now, going, I guess, to the more traditional route, office needs to get repriced. Office, if you're talking suburban office, back end office type stuff, or CBD, everything needs to get repriced. So, Mike was telling me the number of tenants and potential rent that's going to be turning over in the next 2 years in office space. Actually, my old employer, ING, now Voya, I think maybe in Minneapolis, they just downsized, I think, 75% of their office space. Because they have a lot of, and the tech firms like the Facebooks and the Amazons, their office space, a lot of it is hybrid work now. And I think, people that are, tenants that have, that have, you know, deal with the office culture as boomers kind of retire out of, you know, be here at 9 and leave at 5. I'm watching you like a hawk and they're gone. I think, you know, folks our age, don't know how old you are, but folks our age, you know, the expectation would be, yeah, I'll go to the office, but, you know, I expect some kind of hybrid schedule, right? I mean, it's, you know, I'm personally probably more productive working from home than I am working in an office, because I can just roll out of bed and my commute's done.
Right.
You know?
Right. And there's the added benefit for employers that there is no punch out clock when your employee is at home. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can't
tell you how many times I get caught, you know, 8:30, you know, I get an email and I just start, you know, drafting the reply right there. Right. And it's like, you kind of stay on the clock nonstop, which I think is a benefit that some employers haven't caught on to yet, because I have heard there's been a lot of, you know, negative fallout for companies trying to enforce everybody's back in the office, right?
The
employees are saying, I'm out, you know, I'll go elsewhere. That's gonna, you know, respect my time and my, you know, where I want to be to execute. And at the end of the day, if you're performing, what does it matter where you are?
Exactly. And, you know, this is, we're in the age of the self-starter. If you're home and you're productive and you're performing, this is great. And then like you start, can kind of start getting the, because here's a good example for you, actually. You know, we were based in Fort Lauderdale for years.
I went to school just north of there. In Boca. I was at Lynn.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Very awesome. Well, we were in Fort Lauderdale for quite some time. And, you know, I had a cool apartment too, downtown, actually overlooking downtown. It was a nice view and everything. And then COVID happened and the city closed. The city's closed, shut down. Sorry. And you're paying all this rent. And, I had like this awesome gym in my apartment, couldn't use it. I actually, went down to the management office and said, hey, you know, I estimate, probably about this much of my rent is going towards all these amenities I can't use. Like, can we figure something out? And they're like, yeah, no. So I moved out of Fort Lauderdale. I live in Naples now, Naples, Florida. You know, my business partner moved out of Fort Lauderdale and he lives in Wellington up north. So I moved west. He moved north. Our CTO lives in Goodyear, Arizona. And we're on Zoom all the time. And if we're not on Zoom, we're on Slack all the time. And if we're not on Slack, we're on email all the time. And if we're not on email, we're on Signal all the time. So it's like we're all sitting, you know, in cubicles right next to each other and probably being way more productive. Yeah, you know, I could be sitting, like you mentioned, I'm eating dinner and you know, my Apple Watch buzzes and it's, I gotta respond to this email. I'll just jump back in front of the laptop and keep working at 8 or 9 p.m., you know?
Yep.
And, but I mean, all this, the culture's changed. It's changed and it's the toothpaste is out of the tube. And you can't get it back in.
Yeah, it's an excellent visual. Andre, do you have any parting words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our listeners? You know, whether they're brokers, buyers, or potential sellers.
Let me think on that. Well, I guess I'd probably have to split it up. From the seller perspective, again, my sellers are usually lenders and servicers. I recommend selling what you have right now. Right now, right this second. There's never going to be more capital in the market and more aggressive bidding looking to buy your deal, whether it's performing, sub-performing, or non-performing on the loan than right now. Once the sell-off starts, and if you follow with everybody else selling off when, you know, Deutsche Bank goes down, then you're not going to get the same pricing. You're not going to have as many bidders. That liquidity is going to dry up relatively quickly. So even if a deal's sub-performing and instead of 100 cents on the dollar, you can get 80 cents on the dollar, I recommend figuring out a way to take the write down and selling it now to somebody who can restructure it with the person who isn't in at that high number, because your old valuation, your appraisal, and even your new appraisal and valuation is inaccurate. And rising interest rates have made those appraisals inaccurate. Appraisals are snapshots of the past, not foreseeing the future. So that's from the seller perspective. From the broker perspective, my recommendation is start managing your clients' expectations, right? from it's there's always when the cycle shifts, there's always a bifurcation of expectations between sellers and buyers. Make sure your sellers understand, first off, I mean, if they have something to sell, get them to sell it now. I guess that even goes directly to what I said back for lenders, you know, even, you know, in the private sector, if you're selling somebody's, you know, warehouse or selling a retail property, you need to sell it now. You do need to manage their expectations a bit, because on the buy side, their financing is not going to be aggressive. We're out of the lowest interest rate period in history. So just understand that. From the buyer perspective, my recommendation is figure out some groundwork on how to buy notes. It's easier than purchasing real estate. It's very simple. You need to have a legal team that's going to help walk you through the loan acquisition process, look at the loan docs, and then walk you through the foreclosure process or negotiating with the borrower on the back end. But have that infrastructure in place and be ready to move for when these banks and these servicers actually start moving to act when they're a herd. They're all going to rush to the door at the same time. Be ready, because everybody, one other thing, especially if you're buying commercial real estate loans, I know you're all cash. Everybody's all cash for commercial real estate loans. The typical closing time for a commercial real estate loan purchase is 7 days. Most of my deals close in 3 days with 0-day due diligence period. So this goes back to setting up your infrastructure, getting comfortable with the deal, closing all cash and saying you're going to close as quickly as possible. That's how you win these deals and move right to the, get the loan assigned and have your legal team move directly towards the foreclosure or towards negotiating, because the flood is coming. It's coming.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. And I think that if I took anything away from this, it is that the signs are already out there, whether or not you're looking at them. And mm-hmm. professionals like Andre and his team can help you navigate. It doesn't have to be scary. If you're thinking or even imagining selling, you know, dig in. Now's the time to actually really dig in and understand what's happening, because you don't want to be, you know, you're going to be left, you know, holding the bag when everything is hitting at the same time. And, you know, now you can't maximize your exit. It's really timely and I think extremely important content that you've shared with us today, Andre. I really appreciate you for joining us and sharing mm-hmm. your insights. I know you're mm-hmm. very busy and we really appreciate you spending time to sit down with us. Where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? Email, social media?
Well, first off, you can find me on our site, exchange.loans. That's xchange.loans, exchange.loans. I'm also very, very active on LinkedIn. We post our listings there. And I'm active on Crexie. We post our listings there. So you can find me in any of those places. Again, from the seller perspective too, one other thing, just based on what you said, you know, from the sellers wanting to consider, we built our underwriting model into our site and sellers can use it for free. If they have a deal that's subperforming, non-performing, or performing, they can plug in the generalities of the loan and get a estimated range of the current cash value of that paper. It'll even recommend whether you should foreclose or sell the loan. I don't need to get into the details as far as what our assumptions are, but it's a good gut check. If you have a deal that's subperforming or even performing with a potential maturity default that's near term, I recommend going ahead and using it. It's called XL Value. You can download the report, take it to your committee, because I used to be a lender. I know you need something to pass around the table and talk about. But highly recommend getting on there to take a look. Just gut check your deals because things are going to change and everybody knows they can change pretty rapidly.
Andre, I appreciate that. I've got one last question for you.
Sure.
What was your favorite book of the Lord of the Rings trilogy?
Oh man, Return of the King was pretty amazing. It really was. I also read The Hobbit when I was there too. Actually, after the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it goes The Hobbit, Fellowship, Two Towers, Return of the King, The Art of the Deal is the actual order of them, if you didn't already know that. Well, thanks to everyone who tuned in today.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexie.com/podcast.
That's go.crexi, crexi.com/podcast, and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app, or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.